from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mass-scale, white-collar work didn't exist before the 20th century, really. We went through many iterations of how to house and organize before the workplace came to the cubicle, then the open plan and office pets, and now right out of the office for many, free, but on their own. This hour, On Point, work and the office workspace, workplace, where we've been and where we're headed. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you spend your day in a cubicle, or have you fled the felt-walled box for collaborative workspaces, left the office altogether? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Nikhil Saval, an editor at the literary journal N+1 and author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Nikhil Saval, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Secret history, fascinating history. I want to look at it, and I really want to hone in on the last part of your book and where it sort of jumps off into free agency and all the people we see these days at coffee shops with no office whatsoever. But I wish you'd be good enough to sort of take us through those early stations of the cross when it came to white-collar work and workplaces, workspaces, how it evolved. We remember Charles Dickens and Bob Cratchit in the little tank, the scribbling away as the clerk. There was a time, you remind us, where the whole idea of white-collar worker, well, it didn't have much status and it didn't have much of a place to be.
That's right. In the sort of mid-19th century, around the era of those the Scrooge and Cratchit office or Bartleby the Scrivener, It was a very strange, very not well-regarded kind of work. Especially because it was growing. And so, you know, the United States or England, I mean, these places considered themselves nations of farmers or, you know, at that point also nations of manual laborers, factories, etc. And so to see these people who avoided this kind of work and took up residence in these very small, dank, one or two room, they weren't really called offices, they were often called counting houses. And to just not really to do real work. They made paperwork. They were accountants. They were clerks. Their bodies kind of shrunk after doing this work. Walt Whitman, the poet, referred to them as this round-shouldered, narrow-chested generation, derisively, of course.
Yes. And chalky face, hollow chest. He did not like it. Minute leg.
Right. And, you know, and just thought it was a ridiculous specimen of human being. So, you know, at the time, clerical work was really viewed with a lot of suspicion, of course, suspiciously by a lot of journalists who did very similar kinds of work. But that's another story.
But that work became central to the economy of the United States and many other industrialized nations as they moved into the 20th century. And the space in which they were led to work said a lot about how they were seen, valued, understood.
That's right. I mean, especially after the Civil War, sort of towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, you have, well, to put it bluntly, business becomes big business. And the notion of administration, of accounting, of all these things needing to become centrally important to managing these tremendous enterprises, you know, whether it's car manufacturing or railroads or giant insurance concerns, banks, it suddenly takes on a central importance. And there's a lot of ideology around it, a lot of theories of management, scientific management. People might know the management theorist Frederick Taylor. Mm-hmm. All these figures sort of spring up to make work administratively efficient, honed. I mean, they really overload the workforce with white collar workers, and it becomes clear to a lot of people that white collar work is at some point going to overtake, in fact, just the actual making of things, blue collar work.
And yet the factory was in many ways still the model.
That's correct. In a funny way, when offices became bigger, people didn't really know what to do with them. The office was still sort of an unknown entity. And so they did model offices after factories. And in fact, if you look at early films, the film The Crowd by King Vidor, but really all the way up until things like The Apartment or now the retro look back, Mad Men, you see those row after row of desks, the Steno pool or the accounting pool, and they're arranged orthogonally just to, because it's supposed to be like a paperwork factory, basically. And people clocked in and out. They had certain tasks to complete each day. So it, and it had the sort of noise, the typing, the number punching. It was a loud place. It, in a way, it was like a factory.
How did people respond to it? I remember as a kid, I grew up in very rural agricultural life, and then in high school needed some cash, which meant find a way to make a wage, and worked as a janitor, was thrown in to clean a gigantic Steno pool. And I was just staggered by that kind of environment, desk, you know, row after row after row. In a way, in miniature there, there's the experience of a whole society taken from off the farms and factories and put into white-collar workspaces.
That's right. It was a huge transformation, and I think the transformation was sort of most felt by women, I think, because the Steno pools, I think, our image of them, and this correctly, is that they were filled with women, and women were thrown off the farms in particular and had the sort of most menial jobs in the office, and of course the lowest paid, and even people who were doing the same job who were men were paid more. And that was, in fact, a major cultural, people recognize this as this major cultural moment. I mean, there are lots of novels and films about women, you know, leaving the farm, leaving the countryside to go work in an office and into in the big city. And there's a whole new sexual politics that overtakes the workplace and the country. You know, will you, you know, how will you avoid, you know, getting caught with the philandering boss? How will you, you know, preserve your virtue? But then also, what do you do? How do you rise up? Can you rise out of the Steno pool? Can you, if you get married, will you have to leave? I mean, so these things become major concerns at the same time that they're wreaking huge transformations outside the workplace. I think, so in a way, our images of this kind of factory, like numbing labor, at the same time that it was a great source of real freedom for a lot of people to be able to enter this kind of place.
And then comes the root of the cubicle, and it was supposed to be freeing. Robert Probst, 1964.
That's right. This is sort of the great tragic irony to me of the office, is this figure, Robert Probst. Robert Probst was a designer of sorts. He was hired by the Herman Miller Furniture Company in the late 50s to do anything. And he, when he was arranging his own workplace, realized that there were so many different kinds of things that one could try in a workplace that had not been tried. I mean, of course, when he viewed workplaces, he viewed the things that we were just talking about, just this factory-like just nightmare to him. He called it a wasteland and a source of just frustrated hopes, of daily just defeats. And for Probst, he started to experiment with arrangements that were more fluid, were more flexible. He liked a standing desk, for example. He wanted to move between standing and sitting positions. He wanted to be able to roam around the office. Mm-hmm. He saw a great connection between physical activity and mental alertness and vitality. And so in 1964, he, working with a brilliant designer, George Nelson, came up with this thing called the Action Office. And it was a sort of loose configuration of many different workstations, including, like I said, a standing desk.
And movable walls, or something that looked like movable walls.
Yes, it eventually started to include that. The first version didn't work out. It was too loose. He went back to the drawing board, and then he came up with this three-walled, movable-walled space. This was Action Office 2 in 1968, so it was a revolutionary year in many respects. People don't realize that it was revolutionary in the way that it introduced the origins of the cubicle. Again, it was for Probst. It was meant to liberate office workers. It was supposed to be a space that you could call your own. In this, you know, this central Steno pool, you suddenly could have, you know, three walls of your own. You could move them. You could arrange them how you liked, and you could pin things to them. It was your own space. And what started to happen to it is that managers, well, it started to get copied by various furniture companies, and managers realized that you didn't really need the kind of movable, flexible, what, multiple degrees. You just needed a 90-degree box
fixed.
Because that was cheap. Yeah. It was fixed.
Bolted.
Bolted. You could just be, you know, who cares about individuality and autonomy, which is what Probst was talking about. It's how many people can we cram into as little space as possible.
And the next thing you know, everybody's a Dilbert. And the next thing you know, we're even out of that office. Nikhil Saval, it's great to have you with us. Please stand by there in California. The book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Music behind us here from the 2005 film adaptation of the musical The Producers. Sound of disgruntled office workers typing away in 1950s New York. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about work and the office workplace, where we've been and where we're headed, from rows of desks to cubicles to free agency, maybe a corner at Starbucks. Nikhil Saval is my guest. He joins us from Culver City, California. His new book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us when you think of work, white-collar work, whatever that means now. How do you think of a workplace? Offices and doors, cubicles, open space, nothing, on your own? What does the history of office workspace tell us about how we've thought about the work itself? And if old-fashioned offices are drifting away, even cubicles, what does that say about work itself? How it's changing today? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. There was a time when the big prize was that corner office. Here's just a moment from AMC TV's Mad Men.
Miss Olsen is here to see you.
Send her in.
Boom. And she's in Don Draper's wonderful corner office. Then comes the cubicle. Supposed to change everything. Maybe it didn't. Here's a little bit from NBC's The Office. Jim, played by John Krasinski. And the staff at Dunder Mifflin have formed a search committee to find a new manager. Here, one candidate named Nellie Bertram, played by Catherine Tate, explains her managerial style.
First, I'll take down the cubicle walls.
But there are...
Symbol of transparency. There'd be no titles. Everyone has the same job. Same goes for me. I'd take your job, I'd reject the title.
A little unspecific.
Everyone would be known for their accomplishments.
That's very interesting. I feel like there might be a conflict there, and if a conflict did arise, how would that be dealt with?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Scratch everything from before, I'll tell you what I'd do. Go the other way. More cubicles, more division. Everyone is somebody's boss. And that person can fire the person below them.
That's
and once a month, the lowest performing person, bye-bye.
Take all the walls down, hierarchy's gone, until that gets scary for the boss, and then maybe they're all back up. Nikhil Saval is with us. His book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. I really want to push it on out to where we are now, Nikhil. You know, you describe wonderfully how these built environments, planned and designed for white-collar workers, said a lot about how the work was seen. What does it mean when we're past the cubicle and just out anywhere, nowhere?
It's a really odd moment in that respect. I mean, the cubicle, it's funny, the cubicle has, over the, I think about the 90s and the last 10 or 15 years as well, became just the most reviled symbol of white-collar drudgery, thanks to Dilbert, thanks to Office Space. And now it's true that open plans, the partitions coming down, the sort of symbolism of transparency, all that stuff, I mean, that's become all the rage. I mean, of course, the irony is that the cubicle is meant to save us from these spaces. And now people being thrown out into these spaces, open plans are really, they have a high symbolic quotient. In terms of what they are supposed to represent. What they actually do in practice is equivocal. I think it's a very, they're often very unpleasant places to work. People report high levels of distraction, of noise. If you want to actually concentrate or get anything done, you're not really able to do it. You look up from your desk, you find yourself staring into the eyes of someone else. It seems to be yet another iteration, or a sort of, the office is full of fads, and I think the open plan, might just be one of them.
And then comes, I don't know if it's the final step, but yet another step, the disembodiment of the office. You report that Intuit is projecting by 2020, freelancers, temps, day laborers, independent contractors will be 40% of the workforce, and many of them in no office at all, or nothing that we traditionally understand as an office, Nikhil.
That's right. This is sort of the change I think we have to look at when we're trying to think about the future of the workplace, is just the increasing freelancing or casualization of the workforce. I think it means that, you know, the office as such is sort of harder and harder to justify, partly because there are so many people who are being thrown out of it. Or they don't have to be there every day, and they don't even have a place to go. One of the kind of curious artifacts of this, though, is the rise. There's a kind of force that is maybe parasitic on this, which is, people might be aware of the rise of co-working facilities, which are these offices that are shared by people where you actually pay a fee to get a desk. I mean, if you're a freelancer, you don't even have to go to an office. People do pay to go to them, and they're really springing up everywhere. They're in all kinds of cities all over the world.
You're not assigned an office. You pay for your own little piece of one somewhere, co-working with who knows who.
With whoever, yeah. And the idea is that it's voluntary. I mean, you might run into someone. You may just need the facilities. Maybe your home or cafe doesn't accommodate that kind of work. But you may just need company. You may need sociability. In a way, co-working kind of points to some of the truth of what the office may have always been, which is primarily a social place and a place for culture, for interaction, maybe not really for work as such, concentrated work.
It's interesting. I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and I was in more than one coffee shop there where it was obvious, and the coffee shops were even built for this, that there was rank on rank.
Yeah.
Of independent contractor worker freelancer hard at work there, that they nursed those coffees for a long. These had become offices. People had their laptops open. They were almost in rows, like an old fashioned office. But it's the coffee shop. It's nobody's office. It's everybody's office.
Yeah, it's in a way though. The office is just bleeding. It's sort of leaking out of the actual building envelope. It's just you can't. I mean, this is a technological phenomenon, and of course also a labor
yes.
market phenomenon. You just. You may not have a place to go, and you may not need to go there. You frankly can't not work. It's become it's in some ways it's a kind of punishment for a certain kind of liberation. You're free from the office, but everyone knows the phenomenon of not being able to kind of turn off and not being able to not work, and not every kind of surface turn and every implement you have turning into some kind of implement of work. It's a very, so really the whole cities are kind of reshaping themselves to become, yeah, as workplaces. Yeah.
Well, we're going to go to the heart of the co-working movement, at least this week in Kansas City, in just a moment. A couple of calls for you first. Nikhil Saval is with us. His book is Cubed. Blaine in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on with Nikhil.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to do two quick points and then I'll hang up. First of all, I find sometimes that I work in a cube. It's a little cube, but I find sometimes it's nice to go to an office away from home just to kind of get away from, you know, things and have a place to go. And second point is, the cube is not really an issue for me. I think it's a function, like you said, of the labor market. I'm just happy to have a job and have a place where I can earn some income. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
In a cubicle or any other way. Blaine, let me hold that, if I may, for just a moment and get one more. Leo in Boston. Leo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share that I fled the cubicle partially because I wanted to breathe fresh air more often, spend time outdoors. And what I've found is that I actually still spend a lot of time indoors, more outdoors, but I'm tethered to the wall because I need to plug in my computer. And so I think what I hope for next is computers that have longer battery life and that work outdoors, so that then those of us who aren't going to have traditional outdoor jobs can also breathe the fresh air.
Hey, Leo, how do you work wherever you like, outdoor or wherever it may be? What's your boss think about that? Or are you your own boss?
Well, I'm doing a couple of different freelance jobs, and my main project is food blog, newfoodculture.com. And so I'm my bosses and myself, everyone's sort of fine wherever I work. And it's great to be out of a cubicle because then I can just step outside and go for a walk if I'd like.
Are you working? I mean, do you have a job or are you a freelancer? I realize freelancing is a job, but do you know what I mean? Are you an independent contractor?
Yeah, I'm a freelancer. So I write for a couple of different publications. I write for my own blog, which I don't, you know, I don't get paid for that, but it's a way to get my ideas out and develop my ideas. And so most of my income comes from freelance writing and editing and some freelance journalism.
Leo, we wish you lots of fresh air and a steady income where you find it. And I appreciate your call. Nikhil, there you go. I mean, this is right out of the pages of your book in a way. Blaine, who's in a small cubicle, but at least it's somewhere to go, and he's just happy to have a job in this economy. And Leo, who sounds like he's got all the freedom in the world, but you know whether it pays or not is another story.
Yeah, in a way, those are the two sides of the current economy, wanting, just being happy that you have a space to go. And, you know, it's funny that Blaine, I believe, mentioned that the cubicle is not really the issue. I think that's a good point. I mean, the cubicle, it's a symbol. You know, I think it became a symbol because it started to symbolize a certain kind of transience. You know, I mean, Dilbert or Office Space. I mean, the issue is not that it's a bad design, but that it's this symbol of just arbitrariness and callousness of a bad workplace. And so if you like your work, you may like your cubicle. A lot of people get thrown into open office plans, miss their cubicle. And then the freelancing thing, I mean, it's funny that the caller chose to do it. I mean, a lot of it is not choice. A lot of people are thrown out and into contracting or cannot get a job as a permanent employee. But a lot of people do choose because there is a certain kind of freedom in it, in being able to plan out your day and feeling that it's a certain kind of craft of a sort. Anyway, so you know, the fact that all these people choose that, I mean, it suggests a real shift in attitudes towards, you know, what people want from their working lives. They may not want permanent employment, a lot of people.
Boy, freedom of workspace and freedom of work. But then, you know, if it pays the bills, another question. Nikhil Saval's new book is Cubed. Nikhil, stand by. I want to go to Kansas City, Missouri, if I may, and Jesse Levin. Jesse is in Kansas City for the 2014 Global Co-working Unconference Conference. He's also senior cultural chameleon at Brooklyn Boulders. It's a climbing gym in Somerville, Massachusetts, with a dedicated co-working space. They call their active, collaborative workspace above and around the climbing walls. Talk about a non-traditional office. Jesse Levin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the point of putting workspace in a climbing gym, Jesse?
You know, we're really working to kind of de-silo this construct of you know, work or the cubicle notion. And we found that people are really craving tangible interaction. And there's been this massive shift from tech to tangible. And, you know, people don't want to really tweet at each other anymore. They love to get face-to-face. And we've built this you know, really massive experiment around the notion that physicality stimulates innovation and creativity. And have placed this, you know, this very active workspace where people are charged with, you know, doing pull-ups at their stand-up desk for rent, into, you know, a climbing gym where we've layered in, you know, arts, entrepreneurship, design and build, and people have really taken to this concept of kind of a less linear work environment, and you know, appreciate coming to us for at least one day a week where they can be immersed in this, you know, very non-linear environment.
Well, it's linear in that it's vertical. I guess you've got these huge climbing walls, an enormous, a cavernous, huge space, and workspaces in among the walls and pull-up bars. Jesse, you're there for this unconference about co-working. What's the big message? Is this the future? Americans out of traditional offices, on their own, finding workplaces, Brooklyn Boulders or whatever they like, away from anything like a traditional office space?
Yeah, there's really a massive social, you know, social cultural shift transpiring, and it really hasn't been defined yet. But these, you know, co-working spaces that are popping up everywhere are really, you know, analogous to that. And, you know, they're taking a lot of different, you know, shapes and sizes, but there's clearly something going on, and people are, you know, obviously looking for a different model. As my sister would say, you know, where people are really working to kind of rewild the workplace and just to get, you know, more involved, more social, and less, you know, less cramped and tethered to, you know, to a cubicle.
And if you belong to your climbing gym, I guess you can come and use the space. Who else can come? Is it a daily rate? I pay to come in and who comes? Is it freelancers?
Sure. You know, our space is, you know, the climbing, the active collaborative workspace is almost just an amenity. So people will come and they'll climb and they'll take a capoeira class. And we thought that it would be predominantly millennials, but we see a really vast demographic, you know, from older VCs to aerial artists to climbers. And, you know, they've loved kind of interfacing with one another, and the culture that that's established has been pretty outstanding.
Wow. Nikhil, what do you think? We're way beyond the cubicle here. Climbing walls, big ones, and workspaces woven in.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to be a reflection of, I think, something that transpired a little bit earlier, which is just a real disenchantment of the workplace itself. I think when we talk about people wanting to get out of cubicles or not wanting to be tethered to one, you know, in a way, it was not they were untethered. I mean, from the 80s through the 90s, the culture of layoffs, of mergers and acquisitions, of just total precariousness meant that the workplace, you know, it demanded a certain kind of loyalty that it did not extend back to its workers. And so I think there's, you know, there's a way in which now it's like, well, why should I do this? Why should I care about this company that doesn't care about me? I should, I mean, people can, or, you know, they want to actually seek something from a workplace rather than, if they don't have to go to one, the workplace should really deliver a certain kind. It needs to justify itself in a way. And so I would see this as, I mean, this particular kind of very physical, active work environment as being one way of justifying having a working environment at all. Just, you know, you want to get something from it. Whereas before, I think you just went there because you felt like you had to, and often you wouldn't stay there very long, certainly by the 1990s.
Jesse, I've seen the video, Brooklyn Boulders, people doing, you know, pull-ups and wall climbing and then working, kind of all woven together. Is it free agents coming in? Is it startups who huddle between your climbing walls? What's the feeling of it, Jesse?
Yeah, climbing, inherently, it's a very cerebral and strategic sport. So, you know, we attract a lot of coders and a lot of, you know, MIT Media Lab folk, and also a lot of artists. And we get everything from, you know, from free agents to, there's quite a few startups who come in, you know, 1 or 2 days a week just to, you know, to break up the, you know, the monotony, and, you know, to really avail themselves of the physical aspect of the space.
Wow. Jesse Levin with Brooklyn Boulders in Somerville, Massachusetts, a co-working space. He's at a big co-working conference this week in Kansas City, Missouri. Maybe the future. Jesse Levin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about work and the office workplace, where we've been and where we're headed, from rows of desks to cubicles to free agency, maybe no office at all, a corner at Starbucks and beyond. Nikhil Saval is with us. His new book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nikhil Saval is in Culver City, California. With us right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Nancy Kane, historian and professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Just terrific on these issues. Nancy, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nikhil has done this marvelous job of describing the evolution of the office, the kind of white-collar workspace. What does it mean when we're now at this moment where maybe the office goes away entirely? You may have heard Jesse Levin call it the rewilding of work. We're just cut loose. We're out in the world. Where does that take work, Nancy?
Well, I think we're in the midst of a really large-scale transition here from, you know, one way of thinking about work and how large companies and smaller companies engage and incite and, you know, motivate and work with their labor force in order to get productive output, get good work. We're in the midst of, you know, an old model that in which labor was like capital, and so we organized it. If you go back to Nikhil's comments about these big rooms of secretaries, right, they look like a factory floor,
mm-hmm.
right? So we thought of labor as, you know, roughly analogous to capital. And, you know, Frederick Taylor and Frank Gilbreth and the early pioneers of scientific management tried to figure out how do we make the human machine as efficient as possible. And that's all breaking down, including, right, the ways we place people in big organizations, the way we pay them, what organizations seem to owe to labor and workers, and therefore, as Nikhil's talking about, how workers think about their obligations to big institutions. It's a huge shift. And we're only, just as a rough guess, you know, we're only, you know, maybe a third, maybe a 40% through that shift. So when we talk about rewilding the office, or, you know, the rise of free agency, or Starbucks is one of the most popular places for, you know, kind of off-site business meeting in the country, we are talking about individuals and organizations trying to navigate this huge transformation in every single way, including the focus of Nikhil's book, this, you know, physically, culturally. I think 40% of the way through this shift, I think we're headed to a world where everyone, whether you're white collar or you're blue collar, you're a millennial or you're an aging, graying boomer, everyone is going to be back on their heels and pressed to be more entrepreneurial, right, to be more of a free agent, to own much more responsibility, you know, for good and bad. Right, for inspiring and exhilarating, as well as frightening and anxiety creating, own more responsibility for how they're trained, what they're doing, where they're working, you know, and how, in a sense, they're navigating with institutions and sometimes, right, like Leo, right,
mm-hmm.
In Boston, one of your callers, how they're choosing not to do that navigation with an organization, to do it independently, how they navigate, right, the new evolving world of work.
Nancy, work is among other things, is a power relationship.
Absolutely.
Take the physical office out of the equation. How do you see the power relationship changing?
So, you know, in two ways, on both sides of the coin, if you will. So on the one hand, you know, a worker not working in an office doesn't have the ongoing oversight of, you know, of a manager, right? You don't have the person to whom you report walking among those labyrinthian aisles on the floor of cubicles.
True, but they might be following the taps on your
absolutely, and they are certainly
handheld.
Maybe looking at the time that email came in and what the response
mm-hmm.
time was from the worker to the manager if he or she sent out the first email. So absolutely. Right, and we know from just studying, you know, the way that different companies run call centers that some of these kind of, you know, very, very big knowledge work job centers have a whole big brother aspect to them. Again, there's a rationale for this. This is not, you know, evil versus the White Knight. It's not, you know, Gandalf versus the Eye of Sauron in Lord of the Rings. But those arrangements have grown up. So I think workers have, you know, the increasingly free agent workers have more control of their day usually, right? And they have more, you know, more control over which piles of projects or activities or responsibilities they move in at which moments. But there is often less sense of, you know, what's coming next? Am I expendable, right? Is the next project going to lead to another one? And in the end, like, where's my W-2 or 1099 income going to come from? So employers are by no means kind of passing the, you know, the mantle, if you will, or the power scepter to the employee. It's being shared and shifting in new directions.
Nikhil, you write about the contingency of work growing. Nancy Kane describes shifting power relationships. How do you see work itself and the power envelope around work changing as the physical envelope goes away?
Well, at the moment, it seems as if you might even say, in one sense, you could argue, I think Nancy was pointing to this, that Taylorism of the original kind is sort of disappearing, or certainly in its just most obvious, brutal form. On the other hand, you might say we're seeing the final victory of it as productivity skyrockets and productivity is untethered from distribution. Capital reaps so many rewards, and workers are in possibly the worst position they've been in years in terms of the amount of money they reap from labor. So You know, I see employers in a certain way as enjoying a unique moment of incredible power with organized labor in, you know, at an all-time low. On the other hand, I do, you know, the thing I want to point to is that the fact that workers are indeed trying to make their own way in certain respects, and like we said, the fact that you don't have to, I mean, you know, the untethering of work from the physical workplace does create new issues with vis-a-vis management. I think managers are often wary of being, you know, not being able to oversee their workers. Of course, there are technological ways to do that, but still, it's not the same thing.
But and then so they don't have to have the same commitments to pay for them either, or offer benefits and all the rest. They don't face a workplace front gate where picketers can gather if you want to have a strike, or even a physical environment where the workers are together to think about collective power.
That's correct. Although, to be fair, that was never really much of an issue in white-collar workplaces to begin with. Unionization rates were always quite low, and that's another story.
You know, I think we want to be a little bit careful about you know, about painting this as a kind of unilateral picture. I mean, you think about all kinds of growing companies today, from Starbucks to, you know, a local company, Athena Health, to Google. These are companies that are growing and so fast. I mean, you know, Athena Health will hire, you know, they will expand their workforce 20% this year. I mean, these are companies that have this huge thirst for talent of lots of different kinds. It's not, they don't just want coders, right? And they don't just want medical experts.
And they don't care where it is, Nancy, where the work is coming from.
They have an enormous amount of flexibility built even among their senior team. They have people in their sales force and in different parts of the organization that are working all over the country. So you have to be careful here because, and this is true of, you know, the great arc of capitalism, of the history, that at different moments, you know, there are surging needs as certain sectors, you know, race ahead, and there the power structure is very, very different between employees and potential employees and the organization. So and I think that as the new social contract, still inchoate, still not, you know, kind of visible to all of us with any precision, as that emerges, just like as the industrial workplace, white and blue collar, emerged into clarity in, say, the 20s, 30s, and 40s, labor, workers, let's call them workers, they're not even really, labor's the wrong word, workers will rise and find ways of organizing very, very different, perhaps, than, say, the United Auto Workers and their great sit-down strike of 1937 against General Motors. They will find ways of gathering power, but power is never given. Right, it's never seeded in great transformations. Not across genders, not across workers and organizations. It never happens that way. So, we are only in the early stages of a brand new book, early chapters. And you know, I remain, you know, very, very confident that power will never be in this kind of milieu. Be under the control of one kind of side of the coin, if you will.
Yeah, well, the idea was it was supposed to give power to those free agents, that they would be desired, they'd have to be chased.
And many of them have great power. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, you know, Leo didn't talk about this, but I know folks in all kinds of, now, I'm dealing mostly with white-collar, well-educated men and women, but I know a whole range of folks that never collected W-2, have no benefits, and yet are sought after and set the terms of their engagement, you know, according to what works for them rather than what works for the institution.
Danica in Hampton, Virginia. Danica, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you or your guests knew anything about makerspaces that seem to be popping up all over. I'm planning to visit my local makerspace for the first time this evening.
Yes, we do. I mean, that's a version of what we're talking about here. People, not necessarily white collar, a lot of craft and trade going on here, handiwork, but done in very often big co-worker or collective workspaces, Danica.
Yes, I'm planning to kind of just check out what they have, and I really just am interested in seeing the type of collaboration and creativity that's going on in the community.
In a collaborative workspace where there may be shared tools, but lots of room for individual initiative, makerspaces. Let me hold that one, if I may. Luke in Edmond, Oklahoma. Luke, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see, Luke?
I just wanted to comment on a little bit of I guess cleverness from my old boss here in Edmond. He tried to tailor the style of cubicle to both those who prefer an open plan and those who prefer kind of their own space. Our cubicles were kind of like whenever you're standing next to them, they're about waist high. So whenever you're sitting, you can still kind of see everyone, but at the same time, they are high enough to have, you know, your own space where you can put your things and kind of make it your own. So I just thought it was an interesting way to kind of, you know, like I said, tailor to both preferences.
Yeah, absolutely. A little privacy when you hunker down and pop your head up prairie dog style and you can look around. Of course, compared to the old way, Luke, I appreciate your call. Here's Rachel online who says, I want Don Draper's office. Which looks a lot, Nikhil, like a photograph you've got in here of the Seagram Building in 1958, that big corner office with the great view of the metropolis there, a long way from any cubicle. One more, Faith in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Faith, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The timing of your show is fantastic because I am in a moment in my career where I'm working in a cubicle space, a cubicle farm for a large company. I have a good position, a secure position, as secure as it can be. And for this very reason, for sort of more autonomy and flexibility in workspace and work hours, I'm thinking about leaving and becoming a free agent and really just wondering if you have any advice for making that leap.
to become a free agent, to anything to get out of the cubicle. Nikhil, advice for she who would flee the cubicle because she just can't take it anymore?
Well, it's a very precarious existence, and I speak as someone who has fled myself and live a freelancing existence. I mean, the thing that one feels, and I'm speaking to experts about this, for example, the historian Richard Greenwald, who studies freelancing, you find that you do find a lot of freedom in it, and you do find a lot of anxiety. And sort of one of the ways not to feel that is actually to find other people like you. In a way, Greenwald, the historian, mentioned that in a way we might be returning to a certain kind of guild-like model, or that might be the sort of thing that we need to protect workers, you know, who are free agents from the sort of depredations of a very contingent labor, you know, market. I mean, you can sort of develop your skills up to a point, and I think there are a lot of talented people who do command high wages, but you also want to not be constantly, you know, anxiety driven. And so I think it means finding other people like you to kind of work together and know what you're up against.
You describe Richard Greenwald, seeing people moving from gig to gig in an ever more jagged and precarious path of nearly permanent underemployment. And then there's this, one of our listeners says, people keep talking about how the cubicle is dead, everyone moving toward open plan and all the rest. Have they been in a bank, insurance company, accounting firm, any office that isn't in the tech field? I work in legal financial. I've been here 8 years. I have yet to see any offices that aren't set up in the traditional office on the outside and cubicles, or maybe just a bunch of desks on the inside. How about it, Nancy, a core of the economy that's not really moving off the old dime?
Yeah, I think that's dead on. You know, this is not a monolithic kind of process or evolution. And I should say, you know, as someone who, you know, collects part of her W-2 income by writing cases on companies, I've been in companies where there are lots of cubicles and, you know, there's lots of energy and open space for coffee or, you know, donuts or fruit, and there's lots and lots of collaboration and zip and verve. So, again, we want to be careful. It's not all Dilbert. It's not all the dark, satanic mills of white-collar work. A huge amount depends on culture. A huge amount depends on senior leadership's, you know, serious, authentic, right, walk-the-talk attitude toward their people. This is contingent. This is very, very influenced by the priorities and values that are lived with integrity company by company.
Nancy Kane at Harvard Business School, author of Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a great pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Nikhil Saval, what do you take away from all this? Here we're looking into a new century. It's not going to be certainly not going to be the offices of a century ago. A kind of patchwork here, Nikhil.
That's correct. There's a lot, you know, like Nancy said, it isn't monolithic, but again, I think the thing to look to are the workers themselves. I sort of do look to that, any sort of organization, any sort of challenge to the way work functions coming from that. So, I mean, that remains to be seen. It's a really very tense and kind of fascinating time in that respect.
In a cubicle or up against a climbing wall or down at the coffee shop, work all over these days. Nikhil Sabal's new book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil, thanks very much for joining us today. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.